I've been going to conventions many years. I'm sure between all of us, probably closing in on a century of cons. And I know that every minute, every hour of a show is valuable. And so to take time to join us today, we very much appreciate it. And we hope that for the few moments that we're together, that this could be a fun and inspirational time. But before we get into introductions and all that, happy Easter, everybody. My question I'm going to throw out to you guys is, you know, I grew up, my immigrant Korean parents, like, we knew nothing of Easter. And I didn't even get my first, like Easter basket till, like, I think I was married. My wife gave me an Easter basket. So do you have any Easter memories? Is anyone here, like, big thing, little thing? Like, Bernie, how about you? You're white. Come on, give me something. Give us an Easter memory.
I grew up in a house divided, half Jewish, half Catholic. I couldn't care less about either, really. But painting eggs and hiding them was fun. However, a friend of mine that lives in the Bay Area, he's a rocket scientist, a literal one. He lives near the Ghirardelli factory that's up there. And every year, he would order a 4-foot-tall chocolate bunny and massacre it with a chainsaw. And
wow.
That was my favorite Easter to be a part of. Ghirardelli chocolate.
Way to flex, man. Patrick, how about you? Any Easter?
I cannot talk that.
Yeah, no, you can't talk that. Filipino, super Catholic, so I would have loved to have seen that. It would never happen. But I think we did was just a big lechon pig and eat it. That's about it. Chopping it up, but it is good. So.
For the record, I would opt for lechon over the chocolate bunny.
There you go.
Yeah, I'd go for the lechon. Yeah, as Chinese American here, all I can think about is just the candy. Yeah.
Okay, right on. Well, this is called how you built this, or how I built this, and this is basically about how, you know, a question that I get a lot is like, how do you get into the industry? And I will kind of each get a chance to share a little bit about what we do. I'm in the apparel business, and I do some licensing for different apparel goods. And I was wearing our Star Trek jacket, and we have a booth down there that we're doing Star Trek clothing. And, you know, I get asked all the time, like, how do I get into this or that? And what I've kind of found is with, especially talking with colleagues and stuff, is that everyone's journey is so different. And it's like, and I think, I'm sure for each of us, as you look back, it's like, you kind of, it's hard to predict how to take a step into the industry, you know, and some of us get formally educated and some are sort of back into it and all that. And so a little bit we're going to do is just kind of share a little bit about each of our stories and then hopefully get into some questions as far as if you're interested in maybe how you might take your next step. But overall, I'm hoping that we just have a fun time and learn something along the way. So I'm going to throw it to Patrick along at the end. Tell us who you are, what you do, and my next question is going to be like how you took your first step into your biz, and so don't get into that just yet, but Okay. Just tell us a little bit about what you do. Yeah.
Cool. I'm Patrick Ballesteros. I'm an illustrator and educator. So I do a lot of different freelance projects for different companies and in the entertainment industry. And I've been doing conventions probably since 2012. Luckily, starting getting into San Diego Comic Con, then WonderCon, and a few others. But luckily, I've been a staple within our salary in San Diego Comic Con, and that's helped me to grow where I am today.
Yeah. And then about how long have you been doing kind of what you're doing?
Oh, I've been actually freelancing probably and doing projects, I would say, since 2006, 2007.
Wow.
But I've only been doing it successfully and comfortably from, I guess, an artistic standpoint since 2013, 14.
All right. Well, that's sort of like doing it comfortably or uncomfortably. That's what we're going to talk about.
Cool.
All right, Bernie, go ahead.
My name is Bernie Bregman. I'm an event producer, and my team, Experience Level Entertainment, does immersive nightlife and IP development and experientials. So if you guys are down on the floor, the giant spaceship scene for sci-fi fantasy books, all purple and built out and everything, my team developed that. And if you're ever at San Diego Comic-Con, we do Party HQ and do three different fully immersive parties in the same venue, flipping each night. And take over the whole week down there. So, been going to conventions since forever, but in kind of 20, actually it was really when WonderCon came down here from the Bay Area, that I started kind of seeing that there were some opportunities to do some things that weren't really being done, and areas that could be cooler, especially nightlife. Like, we didn't really have nightlife at that point. Or people that threw theme parties would be like pop-up banners and a color pop-up lighting. And I'm like, I spent 40 hours on a costume. That's not good enough for me. So we wanted to elevate it, and that's how I got into this.
All right. Right on.
Hi, my name is Amy Chu. I am a comic book writer, and more recently now, I guess, TV. So I've done two shows for Netflix, Dota, Dragon's Blood. Maybe some people have watched that. Unfortunately, you know, didn't make it past the third season. Another Netflix show, which got axed, so can't talk about that. But it was fun working on it. Got paid a lot more than comic books. on the comic book side, I've written for, I still write for Marvel and DC and just about everybody at this point. My first book was Poison Ivy, Cycle of Life and Death, 2016. It was my first book. My first story for DC, when I started, 2014, that would have been a Vertigo. CMYK, I think, yeah, CMYK anthology, and since then I've written a lot of Red Sonja. I think most people seem to know me for Red Sonja. 28 issues of Red Sonja.
Wow.
Written Kiss, written Green Hornet. I'm the first woman to write the Green Hornet series. Actually, I'm the first woman to write the Kiss series too. So you know, why not? And right now I'm working on the Borderlands graphic novel. Maybe some of you play that game. Working on, something I'm not supposed to talk about, oops, another series, and also the, I do a lot of, how do I put this, they're not exactly charity, it's like non-profit, like I'm doing an Asian American history graphic novel, so that's, I just did a signing for that, that's why my energy level sort of fell down a little bit, but I'll get back up. That's what I do.
Awesome. Well, hey, let's give our panelists a round of applause. There we go. Thank you for joining us, guys. And for myself, I have a background in graphic design and communications, and I did that for a number of years. And about maybe 7 or 8 years ago, I kind of saw this need in the market for clothing that was fan clothing that was beyond just your typical black t-shirt and hoodie. And so, you know, back, 10 years ago, that's like all you could get. There wasn't even like Her Universe, wasn't anything. So it was like, it really was very limited what clothing you can get out there. So I kind of, through a weird, strange chain of events, and I'll explain that later, started a company called Hero Within, and we do fan apparel. We've been fortunate to be able to work with companies like Marvel and DC and Godzilla and Doctor Who, and now we're doing Star Trek and others. And so, so I've kind of been way into the whole, you know, manufacturing and production and distribution and licensing and just all the nightmares that come with licensing and all that. So, well, my first question to you guys is, so I can only imagine, you know, Patrick, your mom's like, she's cradling you as a baby. She's like, I hope my son grows up to draw pictures. That's what I always dreamed of him to do. And for each of you guys, you know, just kind of a little bit about your background. Like, did you, when you were younger, did you have aspirations to do your specific industry? Or even like, was your family supportive of your particular industry and your hopes and desires? Or was it sort of like, you know, unconventional? So Patrick, kick us off. What was it like for you as you're stepping into that world?
So I copied everything my brother used to do. Copy comic book covers, that's what I did, and we did do that. And so I would copy all of these probably age-inappropriate comic book covers, nothing nudity, but more violence and stuff. I would have a field day, and I would do that. I was pretty much let off the hook, because basically in a Filipino household, it is a nurse, doctor, engineer, things like that, stable. And I get it, as a parent myself, I get you want the best for your kid, you want them to be okay. They actually left me alone and forced all that on my brother. So he took one for the team. Thank you, bro. So he had to do all that stuff. But I just wanted to do art, and I stuck with it, and I stuck with it. I was known as the art guy from junior high all the way to high school into college. And then once college hit, I found out I'm not the art guy. I'm not as good as everyone else is. So crap, I need to get better. My parents were neither like super supportive, nor were they like, don't do that. They just basically just wanted to make sure you're alive, you're okay, you're paying your bills and stuff. Like, yeah, I'm doing all that. Okay, keep doing what you're doing. So that's where that was. And the passion, and I tell everyone this, was always inside, ever since I was a kid. No matter what, I knew I was going to do art. I thought, oh, I'll just be a graphic designer. Until after college, I fell into a school that introduced me to the world of concept art. And that was my first step into like, oh, I could actually draw this for a living. Let me explore this world a bit more.
All right, okay.
My family just thinks that anything that I do that's creative is very cool. Very, very supportive that way. But I came from kind of a very Hollywood background. Not as privileged as you'll think when I say this, but and only anybody over 40 will maybe know this name, but my great grandfather was Jack Haley, who some of you may know as the Tin Man with the Boss. And then some other fun relatives. But I grew up kind of going as opposite of that as I possibly could, only to find myself getting slowly drawn back to it as I got older, and then started going to conventions in my 20s. And I mean, Star Wars was my favorite thing when I grew up. I watched a VHS that my dad recorded from like Showtime or whatever. I know VHS, happy to know what that is.
Google the kids.
You know,
Google
like it. A commercial on the beginning of it, and it's grainy, and it, but I would just, you know, wore that tape down. And always kind of wanted to go into genre, which wasn't popular back then. Like, we used to have to get most of our sci-fi content from like horror or comedy or like some ancillary way. We didn't have, you know, what we have now. Be thankful. Even if a movie maybe isn't great, like, be thankful we get so much content. You know, just kept getting drawn back to it. And now we're doing immersive parties and IP development, and it's super fun. And it's, but it's all fan perspective is how my team approaches it. Like, everything is all starts with what would be the coolest thing for a fan of whatever this is to like experience and interact with, and it all starts with that, and then, you know, within budgets and things like that, what can we accomplish with technology? And my family just thinks it's really, really neat. Yeah.
Did you get any training in this? Like, what?
None. I went to school to do psychology, and then didn't. But the thing with it, like, I started, you know, via event production, and you would find that just producing in general is about being organized and being tenacious and being willing to do a lot of research and put a lot of time into people management and just relationship building. And you have to have a tremendous amount of patience. But the on-the-job training, I think, is way more valuable than anything that you could learn in a course, you know? Like, yeah, you can get a few insights, but just being on the ground and stumbling and falling on your face and picking yourself back up is, I think, the most valuable thing. That's how I got into it. I used to do Rocky Horror Picture Show, and I produced the 30th anniversary Rocky Horror Picture Show convention, which was the first event that I ever did. And it was just out of necessity of, I ran the LA cast, LA was going to host that event, and therefore I had to produce the event. And I was like, okay, well, I figured this out. And then from there, you know, I was like, oh, okay, I kind of get the moving parts here. And now I want to do this in this world. Here we go.
Yeah. Well, geez, I mean, in the business you're doing, it really is a psychological thing, because you have to get into the mind of your audience, right? And then obviously just it makes the thing experiential and meaningful and something that connects. You have to know more. It's more than just flashing lights and that kind of stuff.
And if I don't know, like, what, you know, the thing that we're doing downstairs is a new IP. It's a book series that I have never touched before. So I had to, you know, go through the content and absorb all of that and get into that world and understand it and, you know, see all the mini sci-fi fantasy. So I love it from the start. But, you know, kind of put the fan glasses on and go, what would fans want?
Amy, aspirations to be a writer since you were young?
Not at all, actually. I never wanted to do this, never. I wish I was like Patrick. I never wanted to be a writer. I think also because it wasn't like I don't think it was ever an option, you know what I mean? It's not like my parents were super controlling this. It never at any point did anyone ever ask me as a little girl, do you want to be a comic book writer? No one ever asks that. I was super nerdy, still super nerdy. Super nerdy. I mean, like, I was captain of the chess team nerdy. I was the only girl playing D&D at that time. Now it's cool, but back then...
You made it cool. You're the building blocks of making it cool.
No, I didn't make it cool at all. It was, I wanted to be an astrophysicist, actually. My dad's a physicist. I wanted to be an astrophysicist until I failed physics. So I wasn't nerdy enough, apparently, you know.
There's levels to everything.
Yeah. But I was not nerd. Like, comics I came at quite late, because I asked my mom about this. I said, why don't we have comics? And she said, well, because we had no money. So that's why we didn't have any comic books. We weren't buying any comic books. My parents married quite young. They were still in college. My dad was getting his PhD, which meant he made no money, and they promptly had three kids. You know, it's one of those things. We just never had any money. You know, physicists don't make any money. You know, it sounds glamorous, but, or maybe not. So growing up, no comics, nothing until I went to college. And I came about it quite late. I never wanted to do it. I am doing it now, obviously. I really only into it because my really good friend wanted to be a writer. So I was just trying to help her, and I just got sucked in big time, right? She wanted to be a writer. Just so you know, I'm coming at it quite late. So that's why I wish I was Patrick. But even if I was Patrick, I don't think it would have happened. You know, I'm only doing this now, and I think I'm only good at it now because I'm much older, and I have a writing voice, and I have the experience to write things. I started when I was 44, basically, and I'm 56 now. So really, I've done a lot of other things, mostly business. I'm coming out of a business background because I've gone to physics, so I never did. I did a lot of different business things, management consulting, went to business school, I have an MBA, that kind of stuff. But believe me, this is much more fun than writing PowerPoints.
Patrick, I was just like you. I was very creative, very artistic, but my older brother, he's the one that took the brunt of, like, my parents wanted a doctor, and so he went into pre-med, and... So they focused all of their tiger parenthood on him, and I was able to just sort of like do whatever and, you know, be in creative fields and whatnot. So fortunately, while they didn't really understand, for the longest time, they thought I was an art director for companies or whatever. And so for the longest time, they just thought that when they described what I did, they're like, he draws stuff. That's what he does. So trying to explain to them how to design a website, it was like speaking another language. But so it definitely was not something, they weren't necessarily deterring going into the creative field, but they kind of knew early on that I was kind of weird, and I was that was my ultimate destiny, was to be working in the creative industry. So let me ask you, some of you guys already touched on it, but what was that? Do you have a moment where you were like, for some it was early and Amy is a bit later, but was there the moments that you can recall that was like, okay, I'm fully like invested, like this is what I'm doing for the rest of my life sort of thing? Or was it something that was just gradually over time and you found yourself here? Or was there sort of like that defining moment that like, okay, this is it and we're jumping in 110%?
Something that Amy says that resonates with me is that, and for all of you, is age doesn't really matter in a sense. For me, why I'm saying that and why I'm going back to Amy on that is, yes, I was always wanting to do art, but I wasn't the best student until after college. That's when I went, oh, now I know the questions to ask. Now I know what I need to learn. And now I was humbled enough to go out, find the teachers, find the information so that I can actually make this a career. And so going back to your question, Tony, that was the moment for me, was pretty much after college, I had to grow up fast. My dad just passed away. It was just me and my mom. My brother was in the Philippines studying to be a doctor. And so I felt like I had to be the man of the house. And I felt like I really had to take this ish seriously. I had to make it happen now. Mm. And when you get in that mindset of it's now, that's when you click. And that's when you go, okay, what do I need to do now? Where do I need to go? What skills do I need to get to be a master of my craft so I can actually do that? And when you walk the floor in WonderCon, see the different booths, not just Artist Alley, but the experiences, the writers, the signings, all that, all those people are here because they're masters of their craft. So you cannot just, you can learn from just walking the floor and seeing these things, seeing like how much effort people are putting into that. Once you see that, it kind of puts into perspective, okay, not just necessarily I'm competing with them, but if I'm going to do this, I really need to sit down and say, what am I willing to do to get to that level or put into it?
Anybody else remember that moment?
So I started a thing called Club Cosplay back in 2014. And it was a neat idea with a bad partnership, so it only lasted a couple years. And when that ended, I had a different group that I wanted to kind of, you know, take the concept to where I really wanted it to go, but I just wasn't sure, you know, even with them, like I was doing 80% of it, and that's not a good partnership either. Better than the toxicity of the previous one, but, you know, not where everybody is invested, everyone's pulling like their percentage, and it's like a real synergy. That's when you know you've got a great team, which I have now, but, part of how we all came together was from doing that stuff. I was asked to produce Stan Lee's 95th birthday celebration after they did his handprints at the Chinese Theater. And of course I said yes, because who wouldn't want to do that? But that was the craziest fly by the seat of my pants, had no idea, figured it out along the way kind of situation with like so much expectation and like you can't screw up, and so many like oops forgot this, scramble. And about halfway through that event, when like I was like finally relaxing and like there's nothing else I can do, it's just going now, and it was awesome, and I was like, yeah, I can do this. I should do this actually. And I want to do this. And that was the moment. And people that I brought in to work on that are now the XLE team that I'm working with today.
Awesome. And you just came off of William Shatner's birthday party thing in LA, right?
Did that? Yeah. Did Shatner's birthday party wearing your Trek gear?
There you go. And right now, you're wearing another jacket. You have two jackets?
Yes.
Look at that.
Yeah.
Thank
well,
you, man.
You know, originally I went Riker because of the beard.
Oh, right.
Thing,
yeah,
but then
yeah,
when
yeah.
Strange New Worlds came out and Anson's out, it was so fantastic.
Yeah.
I needed pipe.
You got the gold. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. I should have worn some of your merch.
I know. I'm
really
very
cool.
Disappointed
yeah,
that you didn't
so
wear it.
I didn't pack right. There wasn't one single moment for me. I would say there were a bunch of small moments. I think for me in particular, I always felt like I was supposed to know what I wanted to do. I think that's society in general. Like somehow you're supposed to know what you're supposed to do for the rest of your life when you're 16 or something. I think when I was in college, I was watching all my friends. They had to be a lawyer, or they had to be a doctor, or whatever. And I still didn't know what I wanted to do. So I ended up I did a whole bunch of different things. It was always like, for me, it was always about the opportunity, and did it look interesting? And my parents never really said that much, partly because I did what I was supposed to do. I got some nice degrees and all that stuff, and. I didn't really know what I still don't know what I want to do, really, actually. It is very multiverse. I still don't understand how I came. I do know what happened, though, really. Like Patrick said, if you want to do something, you have to understand how did you get there. And because I came at this quite late, what really happened, because I was trying to help my friend Georgia, she said, take a writing class so you understand how the comics are made. I'm like, sure, why not? But I really thought of myself as an auditor. I took an online class. It was something like 6 1-hour classes, and the assignment was to write a comic script. And that's what I did. And then the instructor is an ex-Marvel editor. And he said, let's talk about Amy's script. And I'm like, you know, I'm not really a writer. I'm really just here to learn so I can start an imprint. And he says, it's actually a really good script. I'm like, oh, cool, right? But I never really thought of myself as a writer. But when people like what you do, in business, nobody cares, right? You do a business strategy, marketing presentation. Nobody's like, ooh, that was really well done, right? But when somebody likes something that you did, like when you pull off a great party or whatever, and people are having, suddenly that's a very different feeling. It's very personal. And when he said he really liked the script, I was like, wow, that's like a feeling of, there's a little bit of power too in that. It's like, wow, that is super cool. And now, because I thought it was terrible, I want to get better at it. So that's what happened, is I just kept wanting to get better. And then, to be honest, I was the only woman in that class. There's a bunch of guys who were super fans of everything. And because I didn't grow up with comics, I didn't know any of the characters. And they were kind of like, how could you write comics? Because you don't even know. I remember this, because my husband was also part of this. How can you do this if you don't know who Colossus is? And I'm like, who's Colossus? And what does that matter? And so I'm the kind of person, if you say I can't do it, I'm gonna show you. Even at incredible expense of my career, I was like, well, I'm gonna show you, I'm gonna write for Marvel just to prove a point that it shouldn't matter. It shouldn't matter. And so how does one write for Marvel, right? You don't just walk up and pitch that idea. It's literally, I did all this research, and I was like, oh, I have to make my own comics before the show. I can be a writer, and hopefully somebody from Marvel will say, hey, do you want to pitch for something? Literally by the book. But the thing is, normally, if you even get that far, I was told it takes 10 years, right? And for me, I'm already like, I'm in my 40s already. I got two kids, I got, you know, and I was very much like, I don't have time. I'm going to die of a heart attack. 10 years is a long time. So I literally, for 5 years, I'm out there with my story. I'm like self-publishing my own story.
You're hustling.
I am hustling. Yeah. So this is now my 162nd convention. I'm hustling.
Yeah.
Anytime there's an editor anywhere, I'm there with my little stories and whatever. And so I did it in 5. But it wasn't Marvel, it was DC. It was DC that gave me. But once DC get, you know, either way, you get the gig from somebody else because you sort of cross that barrier. Mm-hmm. And now I can't leave. You know, the whole point was just to get that byline, and now I'm like, I'm stuck.
Well, you know, when people ask about getting into different industries, it's easy to think that, oh, the barrier of entry or whatever is like the connections, or it's the skills, or it's money, or whatever. But, you know, sometimes the biggest like barrier is the imposter syndrome. And so, you know, whether you've been in the industry for a long time, or even Amy, you've got to come more recently, like, do you guys ever struggle with the imposter syndrome and get, you know, kind of feeling, because, you know, when I was first starting out, I would go to WonderCon, and I remember 7 years ago when we, Here Within hadn't launched yet, we were launching just a few months away at San Diego, so I was at WonderCon, and I'm visiting like this relatively big clothing vendor, looking at their awesome design stuff, and I'm just like, I just do not belong here, and I'm so not qualified to do this, and you know, all the self-criticism and the doubts and all that crept in. And so for you all starting out, like, and even today, how do you sort of wrestle with imposter syndrome?
I've found through the years that the best approach, and it ends up being rewarding even though it's super scary to start, is to just push myself through the wall, right? And if I'm afraid of it, then I start like slowly and then picking up speed and marching myself into it, because I feel like you should try and conquer your fears, and then you'll eventually find that all of them were irrational. And all of mine absolutely have been. Like, my dad was a recording engineer. I grew up in studios, petrified, ever trying to sing. Last 5 years, I learned how to sing. I can sing thousands of songs. I've sung in front of thousands of people now. And I was afraid for 38 years to try that. And now it's the most fun ever. And the event stuff, like the booth that we're doing, we didn't do booths, we did events. We did like launch parties and after parties and experientials, but we've never done like IP development, and It was a friend of mine who was did marketing for Stargate and Buffy, and she was working with this book series, and she's like, you know, you have all the skills on your team to be a brand development house, right? And I'm like, you? I don't know, but I mean, there's all these people that do these cool booths, and yeah, and there's no way. And this is our first booth. This is V2, but it's our first booth design ever, and it's beautiful.
Yeah,
and
it's,
I was
it's
like,
probably
oh,
one of the best booths.
All right.
It's one of the best booths on the floor, so for sure.
Thank you.
Yeah. But now I'm like, okay, we can do this. Now let's get more clients.
Yeah. Awesome.
As an artist, you're always going to have that a little bit of that self doubt, but a lot of that imposter syndrome. And it doesn't matter how long you've been in the industry, how long you've been doing whatever, it still hits you. It still hits you in the gut. And you figure out, oh wait, how am I supposed to do this? I did that last time. Can I do it again? It's natural. So don't freak out when you're at that moment of that feeling, and it's going to happen again. For me, it's not necessarily that I've overcome it, but my mindset has changed quite a bit, even since the beginning. I don't ever take myself too seriously in regards to like, oh, making it this big artist. No, my mindset is still, I'm still that person freelancing, hustling, trying to do the best that I can. I also don't look at people buying my artwork as customers. I think them as fellow fans that are supporting me, that are there to share with me the experiences. And I tell everyone this, artwork I create, I'm always a fan of it. And that's so that I can geek out, so I can talk. So the biggest thing for me to get over all that is knowing that I am me, that I am part of the community that's out there, and I'm with them in the trenches. And when it's like that, it puts me a little bit at ease, releasing me my anxiety, and just allows me to have fun and being a person and talking to other people, being an artist, talking to another artist, or engaging in just the geeky stuff of why con is the way it is and why we all do it, that a lot of big corporations don't understand at all.
Awesome. Cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's always there, the problem is like floating there, and it's like that insecurity, and the way I deal with it is not just like, oh my god, I'm so good, right? It's really literally, I'll just read something really bad, and it makes me feel better as a writer. seriously, right? Because the thing is, and this is true for almost anything, there's always people better than you and worse than you. You just kind of have to come to terms with that. And also now I started teaching. I teach comic book writing. Mm-hmm. And so it's very rewarding, but it also makes me feel better because I know I'm good when I look at my students' work. Like, wow. Okay, I've come a long way. I can make them better. But I do feel good because I know what makes a good script now. I know what makes a bad script. And I know what AI scripts look like, and they're not doing it because they're not even spell checking and they're not even doing grammar checks. So I feel really good about my writing these days. And like, yeah.
Well, you know, I used to be super self-conscious about speaking in front of people and just, you know, the whole like anxiety and the hand sweats and the tingling, and just, it was the worst. And and after a while you realize that, you know, no one has ever died from public speaking. Like, it just has never happened, you know? And once you kind of push through it and actually start doing it over and over again and get through the pain, and you just realize that you're your own worst critic, you know? And but in relation to that, another enemy to kind of building your industry is the haters. If you noticed in fandom, fans have opinions. Have you guys noticed that? Fans have opinions. And sometimes when they see your work or your experience with your events or whatever, they don't like it and they let you know about that. And so it's if you make anything of value, it is really hard to not encounter just straightforward criticism of your work. And so how do you guys handle the hates, the comments, the suggestions, the constructive criticisms that we get? How do you guys handle some of that?
If it's online, I just wait for other supporters to go after them so I can just not get involved. I don't delete comments. If there's a conversation to be had, there's a conversation to be had. I think the art of actually having a dialogue with people gets lost nowadays. It's either black or white. There isn't like a discussion you can have. So whenever I can have those discussions, I can. But sometimes it's just people that you're just not going to reach. And you have to realize in any creative endeavor that you do, you're really not going to please everyone. The moment you try to say, I'm going to please everyone, you fail. Because no, it doesn't work that way.
One, do something that you'd like to see out there. Do something that you want to do, that you would want to experience. And there's that niche of people that like the same thing that will go into it with you as well. For me, personally, my art, that's what I've done. It's like, I like to do a certain thing. People go, oh, you should have done this or done that. Yeah, but you're not me and I'm not you. You could do that, but that's not the route I'm going to go. And I'm fine with that. So I think it's, in a sense, you have to like, make peace with that. And like I said, if someone's really passionate about that, okay, do your thing, but thank you. I'm going to move on. And I want to spend my energy on other people that I can actually engage with, have a conversation with, and I do appreciate my art over you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I would tell you, and this took a little while, like I didn't start with the thick skin that I have now, but having haters is a sign of success. Nobody hates on people that are not, you know, doing something that is building momentum and becoming successful or actually success. They only want to tear down when you've gotten somewhere high enough to be torn down from. So once I started to realize that ratio, I was like, oh, I have haters. I'm doing it right. Because just like you said, you can't please everybody. You've got to accept that. But you've got to find your fans. You got to find your support, and you got to find your audience, right? You got to figure out what they want and move that direction, or find the people that want the direction you want to go. But nobody is coming out of the woodworks to get on you if you're not big enough to take notice, right? So if you've got haters, you're doing something right, and you're getting noticed.
I think that's true, but also a little different. As a woman in comics, I already had haters, no matter whether it's success or not, because, right, again, there's definitely a sense of proprietorship over certain domains, for certain fandom, and you just cannot pay attention to that. I'm a commercial writer. I write for an audience. If you hire me to write Wonder Woman, I'm writing Wonder Woman for you, not so I can just do whatever I want. I don't get to do whatever I want. I'm hired because they think I'm the best writer to write that kind of story for that character. So my approach is always like that. It's like, you know, I try to be authentic to the character, and hopefully you like that story. If you didn't like what most people like, you're not going to like what I write anyway, because it's who I am, not what I write. That's the way I view it, honestly. So I just don't pay attention, you know, as much as I can. What I feel like is the biggest compliment to me is somebody who doesn't really like me being in the industry, but reads it anyway and grudgingly likes it. I consider that to be a big win. You know, it matters to me much more if I got new readers into comics and they liked it and now they're reading and I've done my job.
That deserves a round of applause. Is that not? That's awesome. Beautifully said. In our last few moments, we're actually going to go to audience, and if you feel like, hey, I'm interested in being a writer or an artist or something, and I feel like I'm a little stuck, like, do you have any advice as far as getting the next step? You can raise your hand, let me know. And so, you know, my kind of closing thought on that is that there's nothing more freeing than saying, hey, it's not for you. You know, that's so freeing. And so we all naturally want to people please, and we want our product to be able to serve the masses. But to be able to just embrace the fact that, hey, this is not for you, and that's okay, because someone else has something for you, and I've got something for somebody else, and it's very liberating, and it actually is good, because it's much better to like have a dominant slice of the pie than attempt to have nothing of the whole pie, right? So yeah, I've always felt like that's been a very like freeing thing. I can keep asking questions, but is anyone here that has a question that they want to sort of, yeah, let's go with the cap first. Good, yeah. Oh, good. That's a good one. Pitching your first ideas. Any advice for pitching your first ideas? So nothing too long. And we're going to have like one or two people answer, so it's not across the board. So anyone have any?
I'll just super quick.
Yeah.
My number one advice when you're pitching is remember, you're pitching to somebody. You're pitching to that person to know what they want. Rather than pitching what you want, know who you're pitching to. So when I pitched Rick and Morty, I knew the editor was of a certain age and of a certain temperament where I pitched, how about Doom parody? Fastest pitch I've ever gotten. Because I knew what he wanted, and I knew what was appropriate for that. But not because I want to write Doom or Rick and Morty, but I knew that's what he wanted. So Don't think about what you want to pitch to everybody, but what they want.
So I'm doing a tour poster for a band. Can't say just yet. Post them on next week. And I was in the process of pitching concepts for it. So just like Amy said, I did my research. I did my research on the band. I watched the music videos. I saw what their tour little sizzle reel was about, what they're going to do. And I incorporated elements of their backstory, elements of who they were growing up, into my final concept. And that's what I pitched. And I won it, and it got all in final. And it's going to be used in one of the conferences. So there's a lot to be said about really doing the research and coming from that point of view where, no, I know about you and your band, and this is why I think will work, because you guys touch upon all this, and I want to bring that to your audience. Yeah.
Honestly, like, appealing to someone's narcissism is the easiest way. Like Amy said, if you're not out there to just create something for the world to appreciate, you want to solve someone's problem. Someone on the other end's like, I've got to produce this thing, and I've got to be successful and get notoriety. My boss has to say I did a good job. Amy, you've got a great idea. That's going to make me look really good, and I'm going to get a lot of money, and my kids are going to go to private school because of your idea, you know. And so instead of being so sacred about your own work, oftentimes you have to, like, what's the problem that I'm trying to solve for you? And what's, maybe I have something for that. So, yeah. You had a question right here. Yeah, go ahead.
As a writer, I actually always have, like, this passion, and it's actually not a passion. It is a passion, but I'm going to say I have this sort of concern that if you were to actually share or pitch your work, there might be someone that might actually want to take it or learn and steal it.
Good.
There's always that alarm in your head to tell you, like, this may not be, maybe good for you. So my question is, when you feel like you're ready to pitch your work to someone or anyone that actually shares your taste of what you want to pitch, how do you actually know if that person might be the right one or be the wrong one?
Good question. Y'all can hear that question in the back. Johnny, could you hear that? So basically, how do you know who to pitch to, if it's the right person, or if they're going to maybe steal your idea or squander it? But how do you know kind of who to really, you don't throw your pearls before the swine. So how do you know?
Like, how do you know who to date? At some point, you have to trust. But also, you should be a lot more concerned that what you're pitching, your idea, isn't going to infringe on someone else's IP. Mm. You know, like, a lot of, we all grew up more or less with the same stuff. We all have very similar ideas. And to be truthful, almost everything has been done in a certain way. So the fear really should be more like your idea is too similar to something that is already happening elsewhere, because that's actually much more common. What's important is that you do your spin, and it's all about the execution of the idea, okay? So don't worry too much about that. Worry about who you're pitching to that's legitimate. Most people actually don't want to steal from you, especially if you're a new writer. What are they going to steal? They're going to steal something else, to be honest. It's not worth it for them. If you're worried about Disney stealing your idea, right?
I highly doubt with my story. I think Disney's going to.
Anybody, right? First of all, at a certain point, you can also, if you're worried about it, then just do it yourself. The easiest way to control your IP is to make it yourself, and you own it, and you establish the IP over that. That's the safest way. But at some point, right, if you want a book, a publisher, or somebody, that's just the risk. You have to do the due diligence, research them, you know. Anyone who goes out there and steals their own IP all the time, we hear about it super quick. Yeah. Okay, so again, it's just the research, but there's a certain element of trust. But I would encourage anybody who's going to make something, just make it. This technology enables you to put it up on the internet right now. You can do your Amazon book, you can put it on Instagram, you can go to Webtoon. Just make it, and that's proof of concept, and it's secure. As soon as you publish it, you own it, and then now somebody else trying to rip it off, you can sue them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. Sorry, just really quick to add on that, and this is also for, like, the kids in the world. It is a small, it seems like a big industry, but it's a small industry, so if someone does that, it gets around super fast that they're stealing stuff. The other part of that, though, is if you're so concerned about that and you start to put all these clauses and stuff and say this and that, that's a red flag to publishers that you're totally new, totally green, and I don't think I want to work with this person. Like Amy said, it's like, got to start opening and trusting a little bit and figuring that out and jumping into it, or else no one's going to want to work with you in that sense. So.
And you know, you have to be careful not to be too sacred about your work, because frankly, your first piece isn't really worth stealing. It's really your 10th piece or your 20th piece, you know, those things. And so, like Amy said, I think that is harsh. I know it's harsh.
Your first work is going to be your worst work. You will only get better and better. But maybe your first work is really good. But you will get better and better, but don't be too precious about it.
Yeah. Okay. You had a question back there?
No. Also, he didn't say it was natural talent. He just said it was good. Because I put the work into, I listened to the, I did the, it was a 5-page story. I did 5 pages, beginning, middle, and end. My other classmates either didn't do the assignment or they did 8 pages. That's not the assignment, right? You don't, if you get a gig, you only get a certain page count. You can't do 4 or 6, it's 5. So all I did was actually follow the assignment and do beginning, middle, and end, and I did the work. I would never say I was a natural talent at all. I just put the work into it. So I would say, anyone can do what I do, or what I currently do or did. If you put the work into it and you listen, you can be me. But to be a really good writer, it's kind of like basketball or any sports, you can do it. But to be really good, there's a little extra special sauce, and I don't know what that is. But anyone can be a competent artist. Or don't you think so, Pat? Anyone can be competent.
Oh, yeah, you can learn the skills.
Yeah.
It's not just how. You can learn the skills. But
yeah. You have to put the work into it. None of us just came out of the womb like we know how to draw or write. I had to learn. Public speaking, too, right?
Mm-hmm.
160, I've done 3 panels. Every convention. So now I can talk like this. I was very introverted. I don't really talk, right?
Yeah. Well, it's just as we end our time, I'm going to start Patrick at the end. If you can tell us where to find more of your work and where you are downstairs, and then end with if there's one thing that you wish you knew way back when to kind of like maybe help our audience along with like one piece of advice. One tool, one sort of like thing to help you sort of propel you along, like what would that be? So tell us first where to get your work, Colin.
So I'm downstairs in Artist Alley, table 807. Look for a pillar that says C21. I'm right underneath that. All my socials and my websites, just my first and last name. And the last piece of advice that I would give is don't worry about the destination. Enjoy the journey.
His work is awesome. It's very like it's whimsical and creative, and so definitely check out his work online as well as on the floor. So thank you. Bernie?
You can find my team's work at XLE Productions. We're just building social now, so there's you can see a bunch of cool pictures and stuff, but it's not like a huge following or anything. Or me personally at the Beat Gatsby. Our booth is 936. It's a big, beautiful crash spacious design if you want to do some photos. And I think 2 things that I would say. One is take your shot. Stop worrying about it and stop the, work through the imposter syndrome and just take the shot. I spent so many years not taking the shot that I wish I had back. And you never get that back, right? Time is the one thing you will never get back. So just start taking the swing, even if it's not your best, you'll build up to a better swing. And then the other thing is be supportive of other people, not necessarily competitive. Like, sure, you want to be great, you want to get the job, you want to do that, but be the supportive person in the community and not the competitive person. When I was younger, I was a competitive person. I didn't have a lot of people wanting to help me. And now I'm a supportive person, and a lot of people want to help. Like you mentioned earlier, I wore Tony's gear to DJ for William Shatner's birthday and had 50 people asking me about the jacket, and I sent them all to Hero with them. Be that person.
Yeah. He did ask for a cut of the sales too.
So I'm on all the socials, on Instagram on Amy_Chu, but I think everything else on Amy Chu. I'm not the golfer Amy Chu, though. I'm the only Amy Chu in comics. So you can find me there. I don't have a table this year. I think I'm signing at Prism Comics just downstairs. But yeah, I'm just roaming around, and my one piece of advice is just try it. Look what happened to me. I tried it, and now my career is entirely different. You may find you don't like it, but at least you got it out of your system. Some people are like, I've always wanted to do what you do, and just do it, right? 6 hours of my life, it could easily turn in a different way. Get it out of your system, or you find that you get hooked and just keep going.
Well, Amy, as you can tell, is a wealth of wisdom. And so definitely if you get a chance, find her or hit her up on DMs or something like that. So thank you. And then for me, Here Within is the name of my company. You can find it on herewithinstore.com as well as on all the socials. We're on the floor under the big sign 900, the aisle sign 900. We're right underneath there. And my advice is just similarly, just don't wait for your work to be perfect. Just get it out there, because as soon as it's interacts with fans and the lovers and the critics and all that, you'll figure it out. You'll become very clear once it gets out in front of people. So anyway, thank you so much. Hey, have a great WonderCon. Thank you for coming out. Thank you, our guests. Thank you so much.